We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. What if the heavens and the earth had been created in 6 days by a hormonally addled, slovenly, yet eternally optimistic 19-year-old boy named Bob? Well, that's the premise of Carnegie Award-winning author Meg Rozoff's latest novel, There Is No Dog. Part fantasy, part philosophical musing, part comedy, There Is No Dog explores the themes that all of Rozoff's books have explored: identity, love, longing, and the insanity of being a teenager. And it does it with great affection and humor. We caught up with Rozoff in her London home, and she explained how Bob came to be.
I always had trouble with the whole concept of religion, because when I was growing up in the States in the 70s, even though I was Jewish, you're always told that the great creator was all wise and all benevolent. And, you know, it was sort of an extension of the American president somehow. And I could never figure it out, because all I could see, being maybe an early, dark, slightly depressive type, all I could see were the flaws. And as I got older, I saw more and more of the flaws. So I couldn't reconcile that with the all-wise, all-benevolent ruler. And really, it was my husband listening to a program on BBC radio about all the people who'd ever played God in the movies, who said, you know, why is it always old white guys? Why isn't it ever a teenager? And it was just that suggestion that made me think, oh, that explains it. And also, you know, I mean, it's little things like the idea that, you know, creation was such a miracle. It took 6 days. You know, wasn't he a kind of incredible organizer? Didn't he do it, you know, this great God, with such efficiency? But then if you turn it on its head and you think of, you know, actually 25 million species, might have been better if he'd taken a little bit more time to think it through. And all those things, you know, you suddenly start thinking of kids taking exams, you know, having months to study and then cramming it all in the, you know, on the last day. And so it just made so much sense to me.
And of course, what also makes sense is the character of Mr. B, who is the much maligned middle management civil servant who actually takes care of everything. And all the mess.
That's right. And he wanted the job in the first place, but he was considered a little bit dull, a little bit too dull for the job. And actually, there's a real subtext to this book, which I haven't talked about very much, but it is my advertising novel, sort of very heavily disguised, because I worked for my sins in advertising for 15 years. And I hated pretty much every minute of it. And about every 10 minutes, they would fire whoever was running the creative department and bring in somebody yet younger and more idiotic with no experience. And they would always say, oh, well, he's never done anything, but he's got some really good ideas. And he would then, you know, it was always a man, he would then run the whole place into the ground. And then they'd have to pay a lot of money to get rid of him and bring in somebody even younger. So there's a little bit of that. And then the middle-aged man, in that case, the assistant who's trying to keep everything together, is probably the closest character you're going to find in the book to me.
I love Mr. B because it's literally he's got this quite literal world weariness, and it made me snort, because anyone who has reached a certain age and has worked in, whether it's advertising or any other bureaucracy, you recognize that person. Whether you are that person or you're working with that person, you know that there's always somebody who's holding everything together.
And, you know, the funny thing about him as a character is that he could be described as a bit gray or a bit dull, but in fact, he is the only one who really cares. You know, he's worried about Earth, and he applies for a new job. He wants to get out at the very beginning, and he's waiting to hear whether he's got a new job. But actually, he has terrible qualms about leaving, because he knows it's an awful mess. And even though it's not really a mess of his making, he feels responsible.
Well, we can't talk about the book without talking about Eck.
Ah, the Eck.
The Eck.
Now, the Eck is Bob's pet, and he is somewhere between I imagine him as being about the size of a small Adelie Penguin. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of half penguin, part anteater. He's one of the many species that has become extinct over the years. But in fact, in the book, he's the very last one. And the reason that he's the last one, we think, although we're not 100% sure, is that he has supposedly the best tasting flesh in 9,000 galaxies. So poor thing, he's been eaten. And he's a lovely little character. He's the great innocent in a way, because he's allowed to ask a lot of the questions that the humans can't really ask without sounding a little bit too much like they're in philosophy class. So the X says things like, why would anyone perform such a completely unkind act of creation to make me mortal? So I'm going to die, but I also know I'm going to die. And perhaps he's different from the animals, you know, generally, in knowing that he's going to be eaten, knowing that he only has 6 weeks to live. But, you know, to me, that's one of the kind of central questions of life on Earth. You know, what kind of an unkind creation is that? And again, there's an awful lot of post-rationalization. Philosophers all say, well, you know, if we didn't have such a brief time on Earth, if we didn't know we were going to die, how would we appreciate the time that we have? But in fact, for an awful lot of people on Earth, you know, life really is very short and very brutish and without much happiness. And, you know, knowing you're going to die doesn't actually help you enjoy it anymore. There were a lot of big philosophical questions that came up in writing this book.
Did you expect that as you were writing it, or did you think you were going in a different direction when you started?
You know, there are two sorts of writers, really. I think they're the ones who plan carefully, and they're the ones who step off a cliff and hope by the time they hit the ground that they will have thought of a way to end the book. And I'm definitely a cliff stepper offer. I never know how the books are really going to pan out. I often start with an idea or a set of characters. And this one was, I have to say, a real pain in the neck to write. It was so complicated, and I think it was my agent at one point said, well, what do you expect? You know, if you take on, you know, life, the universe, and everything, you're not going to end up breezing through the book. It was quite a difficult one to sort out.
I can imagine that it was, because you are dealing with life, the universe, and everything, and ideas about what it means to be alive and what it means to die and what immortality might mean, because that's certainly part of it, because Bob doesn't age.
No. And, you know, somebody told me, oh, well, you know, if you're writing a book of fantasy or science fiction, you know, the first thing you have to do is, you know, create all the rules for your world. And, you know, in my kind of typical slightly bumbly way of writing, I didn't bother with the rules. I just kind of, you know, felt my way through to the end of the book. So there is some suggestion that some of the gods do mature in some ways, and others of them, for instance, Bob, you get the feeling never will change. But, you know, what I tried to do is I tried to create a world of gods that, I mean, if man is created in God's image, then presumably, if you're going to recreate God from scratch, you look at man. And that's kind of what I did. So, you know, there are obviously some humans who, you know, get wiser and wiser and more sensible as they get older. And then there are others who remain 19 until pretty much the day they drop dead. So, you know, what was fun with creating him was to make him human. I mean, the tendency, and this is really one of the things I really struggled with in the book, is, you know, when you start dealing with gods, the tendency is to make them very two-dimensional. And to make him much more of a almost an extreme version of a human was what became very interesting, because then we could really look at human behavior, you know, writ large, mm-hmm. I guess you'd say. And he was quite effective for that.
Well, Meg, I'm hoping that you will read a little bit of There Is No Dog for us to just give us a little taste.
Okay, I'll do that. This isn't the beginning, but this is the beginning of creation, actually, when Bob and Mr. B are creating the world. In the beginning, the earth was without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Only it wasn't very good light. Bob created fireworks, sparklers, and neon tubes that circled the globe like weird, tangled rainbows. He dabbled with bugs that blinked and abstract creatures whose heads lit up and cast long, overlapping shadows. There were mile-high candles and mountains of fairy lights. For an hour or so, Earth was lit by enormous crystal chandeliers. Bob thought his creations were very cool. They were very cool, but they didn't work. So he tried for an ambient glow, which proved toxic, and a blinding light in the center of the planet, which gave off too much heat and fried the place black. And finally, when he curled up in the corner of the nothingness, tired as a child by the harebrainedness of his efforts, Mr. B took the opportunity to sort things out with an external star, gravity, roughly half the cycle in darkness and half in light, so that there was a day and a night, and that was that. The evening and the morning were the first day. Not fancy, but it worked. And Bob said, let the earth bring forth grass and the fruit tree, and it did. And Mr. B had to admit that many of the fruits were inventive and delicious, with one or two exceptions. Pomegranates, which seemed to be all form and no function, and lemons, which caused his mouth to purse up like a duck's anus, and caused Bob to howl with laughter until he fell over into the oceans and had to scramble spluttering to safety. Bob looked at all he'd done so far and saw that it was good. And he said, let the waters bring forth abundant species of fish-like creatures, and foul ones too. And boy, did Bob go to town on the creatures. He put spines on some and strange colors on others. He added feathers and scales and savage sharp teeth and beady eyes and sweet expressions and razor-sharp claws. Some of the fowl were lovely to look at, with long graceful necks and luxuriant plumage, but others had the most idiotically large feet or wings that didn't work. Having neglected to create food for the carnivores, they began to eat each other almost immediately, which disturbed Mr. B and didn't seem to be a temporary aberration, but a situation destined to get far, far worse. He began to suspect the boy was flying blind.
Meg Rozoff, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Meg Rozoff is the author of There Is No Dog, published by Penguin. Her other novels include the multiple award-winning How I Live Now, the film of which is currently in pre-production, and the Carnegie Medal in Literature winner Just in Case. There's more of our conversation about There Is No Dog at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Just click on the supplemental audio file. You can also find our 2008 conversation with Meg there about another of her award-winning novels, What I Was. And that is our show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM FM and HD1, Milwaukee Public Radio. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.